This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of October 2nd, 2009. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. As I mentioned last time we met, we're in financial crisis anniversary mode. And so this weekend, we mark 1 year since the passage of the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act, otherwise known as the $700 billion bank bailout. 1 year hence, we're trying to figure out the so-called recovery. Pending home sales are up. Manufacturing activity is down. Consumer spending has surged. Another 260,000 jobs have been lost. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing.
If we are indeed on the cusp of some sort of recovery, then it's definitely the jobless kind. The stock market may have risen 15% in the last quarter, but the current unemployment rate is almost 10%. Most of the newly laid off will probably start pounding the pavement. Sure, they've heard there aren't many jobs to be had, but their hopes have not yet been dashed. That dubious honor goes to the 2.5 million unemployed who've simply stopped looking. We wondered who those people are, so we sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to find out.
The standard unemployment rate, the one we hear about every month, counts people who are actively searching for a job, meaning they filled out an application, sent in a resume, went to an interview in the last 4 weeks. But the Labor Department also tracks people who were in the job market sometime in the last year but haven't done anything to try and land a paycheck recently. Maybe they had to care for a child, or they got laid off and they're close enough to retirement to just be retired. Or maybe they're so fed up with not finding anything, they've stopped looking.
My name is Ross Anderson, and I'm 54 years old.
Anderson is one of more than 700,000 Americans officially classified as discouraged workers. He lives in a modest ranch house in the Minneapolis suburbs. Over a 30-year career in manufacturing, he worked his way up from shop floor to manager to owning his own high-tech equipment firm. He shut it down in 2005 after most of his customers sent their work to China. He picked up temporary contract jobs until a year ago.
And it seemed at first that there were some opportunities. I did some interviewing, and then it seemed that all the opportunities just dried up. For every opening that would be announced on a Sunday night, Monday morning, they'd have over 300 resumes.
Anderson, his wife, and teenage daughter are living off his wife's salary as a government secretary. He wasn't laid off, so he doesn't get unemployment benefits. He got a mortgage modification to keep the house. He's also seen a doctor for depression.
There's been just serious retrenching with the family budget. I mean, we cut coupons. We buy only on double coupon days at the grocery store. We're just floating on the very ragged edge.
Of course, in a recession this deep, unemployment doesn't discriminate. Some who've barely gotten into the job market have already dropped out.
My name is Janine Marie Ciccanti. I'm 28 years old and live in Portland, Oregon.
I met Ciccanti at a local farmer's market. She was counting her cash to see if she could afford a $5 sandwich. Ciccanti finished a degree in fashion design last December. Then her student loans kicked in.
And there are absolutely no jobs to be had. I've actually kind of given up. The hardest part is entering a field where you're competing against people with 20 years experience because, you know, they lost their jobs.
So Ciccanti's gone out on her own. She's trying to develop a line of clothing, but that's not paying the bills.
And my husband is supporting both of us on his salary as a kitchen manager at his family's restaurant.
An awful lot of couples like this, one spouse is still working.
University of Texas economist Daniel Hammermesh.
That spouse will have health insurance, which solves a lot of problems, and be bringing in some income.
I asked Hammermesh why the standard unemployment measure doesn't include discouraged workers. After all, shouldn't it reflect how many people want a job, even if they've given up looking for now?
Their commitment to work is clearly less. They aren't looking in the last month, for whatever reason.
And then there are those who refuse to give up, no matter how hopeless it seems. Take James Lawson. He's an ex-con, and though he's been out of prison for 15 years, finding work remains tough. His wife is a medical aide. She supports them when she can find work. Lawson was at the Portland Unemployment Office recently filling out job applications.
Actually, I've pretty much applied at least 2 to 3 places a week for pretty much the past 5 years.
How do you keep doing that?
It's just plain and simple. I don't want to be a lazy person sitting on my butt and having everything handed to me.
Neither does Portland resident Seth Reams, but he found himself doing just that for a while. Reams has a high school diploma and found steady work in restaurants until last year.
Well, after I got laid off, I thought, you know, no biggie. I'll find a job any day, couple weeks. And then the weeks turned into months, and I really just got dejected and depressed. It really eats at you in a million different ways. You know, I'm a grown man, I'm 35, and I can't support myself.
Reams started drinking heavily, stopped looking for work, and had to depend on his girlfriend to pay the bills. Then a light went off. He thought, why not organize unemployed people to do community work, fixing roofs, planting trees? His group, We've Got Time to Help, now has 100 volunteers, and Reams is re-energized.
I'm applying for everything and anything. In fact, I even applied for a window washing position, and I am deathly afraid of heights.
No longer quite so discouraged worker, Seth Reams. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at SaveAndInvest.org. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at POMWonderful.com.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Over the summer, there was big talk from the Obama administration about the need for a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency, a kind of financial parallel to the Food and Drug Administration or the Consumer Product Safety Commission. But the legislation moving through Congress is missing lots of the elements the White House touted, including the need for so-called plain vanilla financial products, like 30-year mortgages and easy-to-read credit card terms. Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren has been calling for this kind of agency for years, and we wanted to get her thoughts on what's happening. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
At this point, none other than the Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, has said that the administration will be okay with not requiring these vanilla products. Might you suggest another spice for the administration?
You know, my view is that there's a world of difference between requiring that every lender create a plain vanilla product and making plain vanilla products more attractive for lenders to offer and obviously for customers to buy. Maybe not every lender wants to be in that market, but at least my view of it is if you're selling mortgages to consumers, here's the basic set of rules. And one of the key rules is if you can't explain it to people, you can't sell it to them.
Then how would the agency go about, in your words, making these plain vanilla products more attractive? I mean, these products were out there, certainly, over the housing boom. A lot of people chose not to use them.
I think I'd take issue, if you'll forgive me for being a little picky here.
Okay.
I actually don't think on the mortgage front that there really were any plain vanilla products. Everything got buried in 300 pages of documentation. I think the same thing is true right now in credit cards, because the whole model right now is that you build these really, really complex agreements, and then hidden back on page 16 was what the company called revenue enhancers. Do you like that term? Revenue enhancers, and where they really made their money was that nobody could actually figure out how to get the 7.9% financing or those double frequent flyer miles. And so what plain vanilla is about not more disclosure. What we need are agreements that people can look at them and read them, like a page and a half long. You got to be able to read it at an ordinary high school reading level, and you got to be able to read it in about 4 minutes. Then you could make real comparisons, and the market would start to work for consumers.
Then let me back up a step. Obviously, when we're even talking about folks having access to these plain vanilla and the documents involved around that, that assumes that there is a Consumer Financial Protection Agency. The Obama administration proposed this back in June. There's been quite a bit of action against it. Are you confident at this point that we'll get it?
Well, you know, you probably should ask somebody who understands politics better than I do. But it's important to look at the Consumer Financial Protection Agency and see who's opposed. It's exactly two groups. It's the large financial institutions who are making tens of billions of dollars off the tricks and traps that they've built into various consumer financial products, and the regulators who permitted them to do this. Frankly, this is a moment in time, at least in my view, where a lot of Americans, let me describe that differently, a lot of voters, I think, are paying real attention to what happens to this agency.
What about the banking industry's argument that this kind of agency will serve to give consumers less choice, that it will tamp down on financial innovation in the markets and in the marketplace?
Right. What's an innovation brought us over the last 30 years?
The option arm.
Right. There you go. Thank you. Credit cards. Actually, there's a perfect example because I've got a great little piece of documentation. Do you know how big Citibank's credit card agreement was in 1980?
No.
It was a page and a half long. It was 600 words. And now that same credit card agreement is more than 30 pages long. What they've really brought us is the kind of innovation, what that's come to mean in financial services, is how many ways can I fool people about the new products? That is the current marketplace. And quite frankly, that's the one some of the largest financial institutions in America want to protect right now because they're raking in tens of billions of dollars off it.
Elizabeth Warren is law professor at Harvard University, and she also chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel for the TARP money, the bailout money from last year. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about the Consumer Financial Protection Agency and where we are at this point.
Thank you for inviting me.
Debt is one of the biggest money issues looming over family finances. It can ruin budgets and put a strain on relationships, but it can also cause something far more painful.
His demeanor changed, became, you know, increasingly stressed, and there was the beginning of to battle depression.
We'll hear how one couple climbed out from an Everest of debt. It's quite an extraordinary story. Hope you'll stay tuned. It's coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Now I'd like to suggest that you maybe pour yourself a cup of tea, sink into a comfy chair, because we have a story to share with you. It's a tale of debt and redemption. At the end of 2004, Russell and Candy Hildebrandt found themselves under a mountain of credit card bills that most of us could not fathom. 4.5 years later, the National Foundation for Credit Counseling named them Clients of the Year because they paid it all off. We asked them to share their experience with us, starting from the beginning, when Candy got the first inklings that something was very, very wrong.
I guess as a wife, I observed Russell, his demeanor changed, became, you know, increasingly stressed, and there was the beginning of to battle depression. And so I knew there was something else going on. And, you know, there were a few flags when we got letters where they were increasing our interest rate. I knew that there was probably a high debt load that would cause them to do that because that would have to put us in a higher risk bracket for them to do that. And I, you know, I did some digging and sat down and found things and totaled everything up. And that's kind of how it came about.
You know, I did most of the finances and did the stuff, and she wasn't as involved as, you know, as we are today. We're both involved, and we both know exactly what's going on with our finances. But back then, we weren't. It was mostly my responsibility and my mistake for not letting her be involved and in doing something sooner.
Tell us, really, at its worst, what your debt load was and how you got there, Candy?
Well, at its worst, when we started the program, we were about $106,000 in debt. Most of that was personal credit cards. There really were no major purchases. We didn't live lavishly. You know, like the average American, it was just daily living things, you know, but it was accumulated over nearly 16 years.
16 years.
Yes. And, you know, prior to having our twin daughters, you know, I did have a full-time income. So I had come home. So I was buying two of everything. So there were increased expenses and a lower income. And so that probably got us started off, you know, in the wrong direction. We didn't live frugally. You know, in hindsight, we could have done more. But again, you know, it's a gradual process. I think a lot of people go through it. And then you look back, you wake up someday and you go, man, how did I get here?
Russell, how did it get to the point where you were $106,000 in debt?
I kind of asked myself that many times. We had tried some different businesses and things, and I always thought I could get it under control. And eventually got to a point where we had to do something about it. And I look back upon it now, and I would never get myself in that situation. I would have did something about it.
Why do you think you didn't? I mean, when you talk about realizing at $106,000 that you had a problem, how did you not realize that at 30, 40, 70, 80?
Well, you know what? At $30,000, $40,000, or $50,000, you know, I was paying the payments every month and putting a little extra on there. And just thought eventually things were going to take off and some of the different business things that I did. And I thought I would eventually get under control and start knocking it off. Basically kind of lying to myself, you know, thinking I'm just going to get instead of being realistic about it. And I wasn't realistic. I was just hoping things would get better. And you know what? Hope doesn't always work.
For anyone who might think that $106,000 is an impossible debt to get rid of, can you talk about how you got started on that?
Well, actually, Candy went to Family Means, and they looked at our financials. And they said,
What is Family Means?
Family Means is works with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, and it's a nonprofit organization. And they do education and helping people with bankruptcies and all kinds of things. And that's what they did. They said, you're going to need to pay this much a month, and this is what we can do with your creditors to get your rate lower so you're not paying so much interest. Some creditors, they were able to get down to 2%. Some, they could not get down at all. But by the majority, they did get down, and that helped lower our monthly output. And so that relieved a lot of stress because it took from 11 different payments to one payment a month.
11 payments?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
11, you had 11 credit cards.
11 credit cards. And then it took about 4.5 years to pay off
everything.
Yeah, everything.
That seems startlingly short to pay off that much money in 4 years. Did you have to take a second job? How did you have the income to be able to do that?
Yes, the payment came out, it was over half of my income every month. So I went out and got a second job cleaning floors at night.
Mm.
And I did that 5 nights a week.
And what was your day job?
My day job was working as a chemist in an environmental industrial pharmaceutical testing laboratory, and I'm the organic chemistry manager.
So you're an organic chemist, and you ended up taking a janitorial job?
Yes. And at ease, and it's nothing wrong with any kind of job, but it is kind of a humbling experience when you manage people and then you have to clean floors at night. And so I basically worked about 80 to 100 hours a week.
Wow. What was that like at home to have to be doing that? I mean, was there a sense of relief, I suppose, that you were working toward paying this off? But boy, the family life must have changed.
Yes, it did. Candy pretty much had to do everything in the household. Pretty much just went a few hours of sleep I got. And I pretty much, on Saturdays, I'd get a nap, and then I would spend time with the family. And then Sunday afternoon, I'd spend time with family. But that was my life, was working and spending time with my family. And we worked as a team, though. She would give me a back rub if I needed to get the energy to go to the next job. Because, you know, I had working 5 hours a night. Sometimes I would not even get to sleep. And I just kept doing this. But we made a decision that we were going to pay back what we owed. We felt it was a moral obligation. And I decided I was going to do whatever it took. And I did a lot of crazy things just to get it done.
You know, I think there are probably a lot of people out there who are struggling like you did. And it's very easy to think, I'm never going to be able to pay this off. What do you think your message is for them?
First of all, quit going into debt and, you know, stop what you're doing. And if you make the decision that you want to get out of it, you need to, the first thing is to find an organization that can help you. And I do mean the right organization. One thing I appreciate about Family Means is that they are certified members of the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. They're able to negotiate, you know, the concessions of lower interest rates with credit card companies that we as consumers cannot do. And without the reduction in those interest rates and getting them fixed, there's no way you could really dig out of it when you're that deep in debt.
So what's your relationship to credit now?
We have credit cards, but we have not used them, and nor do we intend to. We have really worked to live within our means. Wouldn't you say, dear?
Yes. You know, when you go through a program like that, I think one of the side effects that helps with the success of that story is that you do change your lifestyle. I mean, it's a permanent change, you know, so even though things will not be as stressed financially for us, we will continue to live frugal. And it's actually, it's fun to find the deals, you know, and to get things at pennies on a dollar. We will live within our means. If we don't have the cash, we won't buy it. And I think one thing we have learned, too, is we've learned to wait for things. The mentality, too, a lot of times we think there are things out there that we have to have. A lot of times we really don't need them. And when you wait, you usually figure that out. And not always to rush to a credit card to fulfill something that's maybe not even a need.
What was it like to go public with this sort of thing?
Yeah, except for our parents and her brother and sisters and my brother, nobody really knew that we were this far in debt. You know, we didn't really exchange Christmas presents at the holidays, and we kind of drew back a little bit because we didn't have money to do extra things. And I was happy that in June this was done with. I didn't have to tell anybody. We paid everybody back, and I just wanted to go back to living. You know, mm-hmm. I got rid of my second job in the end of June, and I was happy to be home with my family and be able to sleep nights, and I just kind of wanted to move on. And then we got nominated for this award, and then all of a sudden it's like, now we got to talk about it. And we could have made a decision not to talk about it,
yeah.
But they said, you can really help others. And we've been involved in our church and been involved in helping people for many years, and we decided, well, we're just going to step out. And
what was the reaction?
Well, a lot of good reaction. A lot of families like, wow, I can't believe you were this much in debt. And we have a lot of reaction people. We have people call our house out of the blue and say, we're inspired by you. And you also have people that are negative and not, you know, I can't believe you did this, or you were idiots to get there in the first place. And I would agree with them. Okay. I was an idiot to get there in the first place, but at least I wised up and I did it and I corrected a mistake, and nobody's perfect. And so we made some mistakes, but it's helping people. And I think you can take a bad situation and make it good. And that's what we did.
How did you celebrate once you paid off all that debt and were able to stop your second job?
My last night when I left the grocery store, I screamed, I'm done, as loud as I can at 5 in the morning in the middle of New Richmond, Wisconsin. And I was quite happy. And then that weekend, we went to stop that famous Dave barbecue. I don't know if I should have mentioned it or not, but we did. And we bought like $50 worth of barbecue, and we went home and we had a big feast on Sunday. And we just were happy as can be. It was that we didn't go extravagant, but it was just like we would have never done that in the last 4.5 years. But we had the money, and we just went out and just had one big Sunday. And the girls they loved barbecue, and we had a good time, and we laughed. And I didn't have to go to work anymore except for my regular job, and it was just the start of a new life.
And what about the household budget? Is it something that you work on together now?
Yes.
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 We have grown closer, actually, because we've had to struggle together. And I couldn't have did it without her, and I don't think she could have did it without me. We did it together as a team. And I know I've grown to love her and appreciate my wife more and appreciate things more. And so I would not want people to ever go through this situation, but it did make us better people.
Russell Hildebrandt, Candy Hildebrandt, thank you both for sharing your story. I'm sure it's going to help a lot of folks. So very brave of you to talk about this. And we really appreciate you coming in. Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
We've got links to information about credit counseling and photos of the Hildebrandts on our website. If you have a story to share about getting out of debt, we'd love to hear it. Go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we take on your questions. And here with me this week to do that is our good friend Liz Plame Weston, who is a personal finance columnist for MSN. Welcome back to the show, Liz.
Thanks, Tess. It's good to be here.
First, we have Charlie on the phone, and he is in Hopkins, Minnesota. Hi there, Charlie.
Hello.
How can we help you out today?
Well, I have a question for you about a house, our house in particular. My wife and I are contemplating moving in about 4 years. And we're debating about whether or not to save our money for a down payment for a new house or to put money towards some remodeling projects in terms of improving the livability of the house. Hmm. If we do these remodeling projects, we'd like to enjoy the house, but we're more concerned with the moving in about 4 years. So we're not exactly sure where to put our money.
Liz, I think this is a question that a lot of folks are asking themselves, particularly in this housing market. You know, do I hang on, wait a little while, see what happens with the market, maybe do a little investment in my current home? What would your advice be here?
Well, the word investment just sets me off because we have this national delusion that the money we put into our house, into remodeling, is actually an investment, and it's not. You know, at best, when you put money into your house, most projects you're going to get back 70-80% on the dollar. Now, if you're an investor in a Bernie Madoff scheme, maybe that's a good return for you. But the rest of us, you know, why would you give somebody $100 only to get 80 back? So what I want to ask Charlie is, what kind of things are you thinking about? What sort of remodeling projects are high on your list?
Four things, really. We need to replace our air conditioner and our furnace, and then we want to refinish half the basement and add siding with insulation to the house. It was a 1922 farmhouse.
Liz, those sound very practical. Those aren't, you know, getting a sub-zero fridge and
granite countertops.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, this is something that presumably would certainly help sell the house when they decide to do that.
It could. But again, you could put a lot more money into this stuff than you'll ever get back. So what I'm thinking is, some of the things you're talking about are basic maintenance. I mean, replacing the air conditioner and the furnace might be something you have to do because that's what the next buyer is going to expect. They want a house in decent condition. So you might need to look into that. When it comes to the siding, that might be kind of a maintenance sort of thing. I'm not sure about the basement refinishing. That's probably going beyond the call.
Yeah.
And the insulation actually is something you might want to consider because there's a tax break this year and next. So that could be something to help with the cost. But let me ask you, do you have the cash sitting around somewhere to pay for this?
No, we do have some cash put away, but for different reasons. And so we would probably have to take out a line of credit to pay for these remodeling projects.
Okay. How does the balance on your mortgage compare to what the house is worth?
Well, according to the property tax statement we get from the county, and I talked to our mortgage company 2 weeks ago just to get an estimate, and they are roughly the same amount.
Ouch.
Yeah, that's going to be a problem, Charlie, because right now lenders are unwilling to stick their neck out. If you don't have 20% or more equity in your house, it's going to be tough to get a line of credit. Out here in California, it might have to be 60 or 65%.
Really?
Okay.
Yeah, because they're terrified of falling prices and they don't want to wind up giving you a loan that they're not going to get back.
Okay.
What I would say, since most of the stuff you're talking about is maintenance repair kind of stuff, which you should be paying out of pocket, I would really err on the side of trying to pay for that with cash.
Okay. Yeah, and we can reconsider kind of what we have that other money set aside for. That makes sense.
Okay, good.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you for your help. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, Liz, we have Sophie on the line with us from Red Oak, North Carolina. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, and you?
Just fine, thanks.
What's your question for us today?
Well, we have our home up for sale, and we expect to make a pretty good return on it if and when it does sell. And we're looking at downsizing, so we're looking at a condo.
Mm-hmm.
And we could put down probably as much as 60% as a down payment, but I'm not sure if that's a really wise thing to do.
Liz, perhaps the question here is how long they would expect to stay in the condo.
That's an excellent question. And also, when do you plan to retire? Do you have ideas of answers to those questions?
I would think about 10, maybe 15 years to retirement. And that might actually be the last house for us. We're looking at moving to where we want to retire. So.
Well, in that case, if you put down 50, 60%, there's a good chance you could potentially pay it off by the time you retire, right?
Right. We're looking at probably a 15-year mortgage, so that we won't have any mortgage payments when we retire, and we usually pay off our houses early.
So what do you think, Liz?
Well, I think for most younger people, it makes sense to take that 30-year mortgage and take your time paying it off because it's incredibly cheap money, and you usually get a tax deduction. When you're getting close to retirement, though, it's really nice to have that loan paid off. You
right.
know at least you can keep your house no matter what. So I would err on the side of putting that bigger down payment. Yes, you will be tying up a big chunk of change in your condo.
Okay.
That level of comfort of having that loan paid off by retirement, I think, is worth the investment.
Now, does it make any difference that it's a condo?
You know, the rules on condos are changing just because condo values have fallen so quickly. They've fallen
right.
actually more than single family houses, which is what happens in any recession. They tend to, you know, lose value first and take more time to regain their value. Also, what happens is that when people start losing their condos to foreclosure or they can't sell them, they decide to rent them. So more renters come in, and then it can be harder to get a loan. But the bigger the down payment you have, the more leverage you've got.
Yeah, I would think 50-60% is not something they see very often. So
rolling up,
you'll be one of those people where the bank is like, yes, please bring us your mortgage.
Help, we could just find a buyer for our house, right?
That's the other part of it. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Sophie. Bye-bye. And whether you are downsizing or upsizing or sideways sizing, if you need help, do give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or you can email us with your question. Just look for the Getting Personal link at our website, and that is marketplace.org. We'll be back with more advice from MSN columnist Liz Pulliam Weston later in the show. We heard earlier this hour just how important financial honesty is in a relationship. But if you're single, how do you find that person who fits your goals and beliefs so you can avoid surprises like this one?
What is this? Why did you buy this boat? We don't need a boat. Oh, and that's not all.
Coming up, finding your perfect financial match. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Remember when you were a kid, how you looked forward to certain events that came to town once a year? Like the fair or the circus. Well, these days, folks are marking their calendars to catch a different kind of show. Call it a foreclosure circus. This weekend, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America is visiting Phoenix. The organization is crisscrossing the country to help homeowners modify their mortgages. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler caught the road show when it pulled into Los Angeles last weekend.
On the Save the Dream tour, the day starts with a sing-along.
We are NACA! We are NACA! Marty, Marty, NACA!
NACA, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, is an advocacy group that pressures banks to modify home loans. That can range from lowering the interest rate to cutting the total amount owed on the home. The tour is funded with federal grant money. Plus, the lenders who cooperate with NACA pay the organization up to $500 for every borrower who makes the modified payments on time for 3 months. Banks have an incentive. Foreclosures are expensive, and some return on a property is better than none. Over 5 days, some 50,000 people file through the L.A. Convention Center. Many are initially skeptical. Roger Perez has been paying his lender only part of his monthly mortgage payments. He can't afford to pay the whole thing since his heating and air conditioning business went south along with the economy.
I tried remodifying the loan at first on my own, and the banks weren't listening to me. They kept losing my letter. They kept losing all my paperwork. They kept saying, we'll get back to you, we'll get back to you, and they never got back to me.
Perez even hired a lawyer to help him.
I spent $3,500, and it just didn't do anything for me.
Mortgage foreclosure scams are a growing problem around the country. By contrast, the NACA event aims to modify loans for free in a single day. Participants start by registering, then sit through an orientation.
Your counselor is going to sit there and look at where your money is currently going, and they're going to ask you to do what makes sense. It may not make sense to ask a servicer to change your mortgage payment from $2,000 a month to $1,000 a month when you're spending $1,000 a month eating out.
Next, homeowners wait with hundreds of others to speak to a counselor. The NACA formula for modifying loans subtracts household expenses from the money coming in after taxes. That determines how much the homeowner can afford. Equipped with this estimate, the borrower meets with the lender. Wells Fargo and Bank of America are among the banks that have chosen to have representatives here ready to modify mortgages. They ask not to be recorded. Still, there's plenty of evidence about the kinds of mortgage deals being struck.
Bank of America took it from a 6.78% interest rate down to a 2-point interest rate, reducing my monthly payment from $4,375 to $2,600 per month, a near savings of $1,800.
That's 53-year-old Joe Vaccarelli.
I was behind 5 months on my monthly mortgage due to the fact that self-employed business took a real hit.
He spent 26 hours over 2 days at the NACA event.
Had I not done something, they would have definitely put the house into foreclosure in the next 4 weeks.
When a friend told him about the event, Vaccarelli almost didn't come.
And I said, oh, it's probably a joke.
He wasn't the only one who thought it was too good to be true. That's one reason for the testimonials broadcast throughout the day, including one from Vaccarelli.
Down to 2%.
Not everyone gets a 2% loan. Not everyone gets their issue resolved. And on the other side of the table, not every lender agrees to take part. Financial companies that don't negotiate with NACA tend to become targets of more direct action. NACA's CEO, Bruce Marks, brings frustrated mortgage holders to the homes of financial bigwigs, like the CEO of Morgan Stanley.
NACA's nonviolent bank terrorism is when we take hundreds of homeowners and we go to the gated communities where the CEOs live, and we, in a nonviolent way, say, we want you to be accountable for your actions. We want you to meet the homeowners who you're foreclosing on.
Many of the homeowners who are rescued by NACA feel so grateful that they want to give back. Some sign on to be protesters and risk arrest. Others are content to volunteer at NACA events and sing the program's praises. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
We are back with more Getting Personal, and that means more answers from MSN finance columnist Liz Plamewest. And hi, Liz.
Hi, Tess.
Erica is on the line in Washington, D.C. Hi, Erica.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What's your question for us today?
Yeah, I actually had a question. I guess one could say that I have a clean slate in terms of investing. I'm a 25-year-old who works at a nonprofit in D.C., and I only have a checking account.
That is a clean slate. Good for you.
But I do have, I mean, it's not a clean slate in terms of loans. So I'm contributing more than I have to in order to pay off my loans. It's kind of been a priority of mine. But it's also been hammered into me since I graduated that I should start a Roth IRA.
Well, Liz, maybe the first question is, how big is this loan debt?
Well, and what type of loans are those?
Yeah, well, some of them are private. And then I do have some federal loans.
What's the total that you owe on the two types of student loans?
It's about $60,000.
Okay. That is a chunk of change, and I'm guessing if you're working at a nonprofit, you're probably not making $60,000 a year, are you?
Exactly.
Okay.
No.
All right. Well, here's some good news. Those federal student loans, you absolutely do not have to worry about. That is some of the cheapest money that you're ever going to find. So what I would suggest with that is, have you consolidated those loans yet?
Yeah, I have.
That's great. Pay those off on schedule. Where you want to put the extra money is toward the private loans, because private loans have higher interest rates. They're variable, unlike the fixed student loans. So don't sweat the federal loans, but sweat the private loans and put some money there. Now, you had said that you know you need to be saving for retirement. Does your nonprofit have a 403B or other retirement plan?
Yeah, so what they do is they contribute, I think it's 10% of the base salary.
Ah.
Wow, that's generous.
Nice.
Yeah.
They contribute 10% no matter what, right?
Right, exactly.
Oh, sweet. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that changes the situation a little bit. Then I probably would go for a Roth. I mean, you can put some more money into the 403B, and you do get a tax break for that. But I think given how young you are, you probably want to have money in different tax buckets, because the 403B money, when it comes out, that's going to be taxable. The Roth contributions, you don't pay tax on up front, but you get it tax-free in retirement. And it's just nice to have the flexibility of having money in both of those buckets.
Yeah.
And you're so smart to get started now, because if you waited even 5 years, because of the compounding and the value of time, you would probably wind up with 30% less. Just getting started will make a huge difference in your finances.
But then, Liz, how does she make the decision whether to be more aggressively paying down the non-federal student loans versus going ahead and starting a Roth IRA?
That's a great question, and it's one that faces a lot of people. How do I pay off my debt? How do I prioritize retirement? Because you have that 10% right off the top, it would be nice if you could to squeak out 5% more to get you in that 15% bracket. And what that does, since you're starting early, that means you might be able to retire early. So you have to do some juggling and see if it's possible.
The extra 5% meaning going into my retirement here at work or into a Roth IRA, or does it matter?
You know, it's up to you. If you want the extra tax break, I'm not sure what tax bracket that you're in. So if you want a bigger tax break, you'd put the money, more money into the 403B. If you can live without that tax break, I'd do the Roth IRA just because it's so much more flexible.
Okay. How does one go around shopping for a Roth IRA?
That's a great question. Any bank, any brokerage firm would be happy to open a Roth IRA for you. The problem is if you go to a brick and mortar bank or a traditional brokerage, they're going to charge you fees. If you're just getting started, I would say go look for a discount mutual fund company, discount brokerage, because they are kind of set up to help the small person get going. Vanguard, T. Rowe Price, Fidelity. And because you're new to investing, I would strongly encourage you to look into what's called the target date maturity funds. And basically, this is a one-stop shop. You look for a retirement fund that has a number that's close to the time when you're going to retire. So say you're going to retire at 65, 40 years from now, you would look for a 2050 fund and put your money there. As you learn more about investing, you might want to branch out a bit from that, but that'll at least get you started.
Okay.
Does that help you out, Erica?
Yeah, great.
Let us know how it goes for you.
Great. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for questions on this week's show, but you can ask us a question anytime. Give us a call at 877-275-6669 or leave your question for us at marketplace.org. You'll find the Getting Personal link there. Thanks so much, Liz, for joining us today and giving our listeners some great advice. Appreciate it.
That was a lot of fun. Thanks, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing and online surveys. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You'd think in a recession that couples would turn to one another for comfort. In a poll released a couple of months ago by ING Direct, almost a third of Americans said the economy has added stress and even ruined their marriages and other romantic relationships. On the other hand, some of the more popular online dating sites like eHarmony and Perfect Match are reporting double-digit growth. But for all the love connections, there is not much talk of money compatibility. Sally Herships reports.
Diana Rafe lives in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. She used to run a crane and a forklift in a steel mill. Life was good. She was making big money. She fell in love with a local guy, got married. That's when the problems started. Her mom got sick, and Arafe had to head out of town to see her. When she got home, she found a boat in her yard. Turns out her husband had gone shopping.
What is this? Why did you buy this boat? We don't need a boat. Oh, and that's not all. On top of the boat, there were the car racing parts. $6,500 for a supercharger for his Mustang. And then there was the racing.
Not long after, they were divorced. Arafe did end up looking for love again, eventually. But this time, she wanted to be more cautious, to find a guy who shared her attitude towards money. So she went online. Digital daters will tell you one benefit of using a dating site is pre-screening. Arafe asked potential dates if they were spenders or savers, if they liked going out for big meals and worrying about the bill later.
Sometimes it's not enough to be just in love. Well, I was definitely in love with my ex-husband, but it didn't last. He ended up misusing money, and it hurt me very badly. It seemed like the ultimate disrespect.
eHarmony is perhaps the best-known site for questioning daters.
At eHarmony, we pre-screen each and every member for you to determine your matches based on compatibility.
But although they ask more than 250 questions, only one is about money. Here it is. How frugal are you? eHarmony says its method of matching is the ideal barometer for predicting healthy pairs, so it doesn't need to ask specific questions about money habits. But PerfectMatch.com says you do need to ask. Dr. Pepper Schwartz created the matching algorithm for the site. She says money questions are so important, Perfect Match even offers a test called Money and Economic Aspirations.
Now with the economic downturn, I need to think and worry about money much more than I used to. That might be different. I like to buy really, really nice things and have often spent more money than I really can afford. Those are two different kinds of people, you know?
I asked Schwartz how she knows which questions to ask.
I don't pretend to understand attraction, but I do know that there's a literature that talks about long-term compatibility. I can tell you, for example, that we have very good social science information that if people don't pool all their money, they will fight about money less.
Translation. Schwartz says her research shows if a married couple keeps separate accounts as well as a joint account, they tend not to argue about money as much. Schwartz says Perfect Match asks questions to figure out what you expect financially in a relationship. Like, I'd very much prefer to be with someone who earns more money than I do and is financially secure. True or false? But can an online test score a perfect union? Eli Finkel is a psychologist at Northwestern University, and he says the success of these dating sites has yet to be proven. But he says one thing we do know is that actually daters don't know what they want, especially about money. Confused? Here's an example. A single woman, we'll call her Jasmine, participated in a speed dating study Finkel did.
And she was at the very top of the scale in terms of her preferences for a man with good earning prospects, even in a speed dating partner.
In other words, Jasmine wanted a man with money. But then, the classic story. Girl meets boy, girl changes her mind. But since this is speed dating, Jasmine changes her mind really fast.
Well, what he wants to do is play the trombone on a cruise ship.
Not exactly a guy with big bucks. Finkel says that's the danger with online dating, screening, and money. People might think they know what they want, but put the same group in a room together, and predefined ideas like Jasmine's will fly right out the window.
There's reason to believe that asking people what they want is not the best way of getting at what they actually want.
So if you're single, Finkel says, don't try to pick your own online match. You might miss out on your trombone player. Or you can just remember the most important question you can ask about money in a relationship is whether someone is willing to answer more questions about money in that relationship. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
The movie Zombieland comes out this weekend, and I really hope you're paying attention because it gives some pretty good rules for hunting the living dead.
Welcome to Zombieland. Rule number three, call me a goody two-shoes, seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
And as with just about everything in Hollywood, you can apply these lessons in your everyday life, especially when it comes to investing. You know, of course, that huge companies like Washington Mutual and Lehman Brothers, they're dead. But their shares still lurk around some trading floors. They're called zombie stocks. The SEC does not force a company to stop trading until bankruptcy is done, and that can take months. Meantime, shares go up and down as if the company's still alive. Well, last fall, John Lane put about $3,000 in zombie stocks. He called it his lottery portfolio, and a week ago, he cashed out.
I sold it all for about $13,400. 470% profit.
Woo! But be warned, most of the undead do not rise from their ashes. Berkeley finance professor Terry O'Dean says some grave robbers can't help but think these stocks are a great deal.
A company that was once powerful and vibrant is a company that there will be some investors who just can't believe it's really dead.
Rest assured and in peace, they are. And how do you tell a zombie company? Well, look for a Q after the stock symbol, and then run for your lives!
The zombie. The zombie, whoa, yeah.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, when you're the only one in the family who speaks English, you might end up dealing with bills and mortgages before you even become a teenager.
Couldn't imagine, like, other children having to do what I was doing. Hey, I went to the bank yesterday with my mom. What did you do after school?
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troe. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org. Or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing.
American Public Media.